This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
And to start us off today, I'm very pleased to be able to introduce Richard Falk. Besides all his other accomplishments, the most important one now is the fact that he is a permanent fellow of the Orfila Center. And it was one of my great delights when I became director to inherit Richard's expertise and simply presence, quite frankly. Richard, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I thought you were going to say that my survival was the most outstanding accomplishment. Let me say that I found very stimulating and impressive the presentations yesterday. And a lot of what particularly Clark McCauley said resonates with my own... Oh, we arranged it. It took hours. resonates very much with the way I think... have tried to think about these issues. I guess unlike the presentations I heard yesterday, I approach the subject matter of terrorism from an international relations and international law perspective. And just one reflection on yesterday's presentations and discussions made me feel that it would be very useful somewhere in this project to have some comparative material with taking account of how large-scale terrorist incidents are appreciated in other major countries like India, Russia, China, Japan. Because it seems I start from the hypothesis that there is something very distinctive about American political consciousness that bears on the way in which these large-scale terrorist incidents are perceived and how they are, and the response pattern that is generated by these events. I thought of it particularly when listening to Michael Stoll's and Ben Smith's presentation. It would be very interesting to know if a similar pattern would be encountered in societies other than U.S., Israel, U.K., and U.S. I think there's something that they share in common in relation to this subject matter that is different from what I would speculate one would find in these other major countries as a response. The focus that I want to attempt in these few minutes is to consider what I call mega-terrorist, the mega-terrorist challenge. The challenge that is associated with 9/11, with the Paris attacks, but also, given much less attention, the Madrid bombings of March 11th, 2004, and the London bombings the following year, in the underground and bus. And my... interest in this is partly just one other aspect of the background to my own way of thinking about these issues. I began being interested in terrorism not as long ago as Michael, but almost when I became involved with the Israel-Palestine conflict. And what struck me about that conflict was the degree to which Israel succeeded in painting the Palestinian struggle in terms of its terrorist tactics. And that was used very effectively, in my judgment, to erase the legitimate grievances of the Palestinian people. In other words, it was a very instrumental use of the politicization of terrorism as a way of addressing a conflict in a manner that prevented its solution in a way. And Israel continues to do that in dealing with Hamas as a terrorist organization that exempts it from the need to deal with the grievances of the Palestinians, or at least it contributes to that posture. And I recall anecdotally a presentation I heard that John Major, the former British Prime Minister, made, supposedly off the record, in which he said that when he was dealing with Northern Ireland, he only made progress when he stopped thinking of the IRA as a terrorist organization and began to realize that they were a political actor with real grievances. And at that point, the diplomacy began to develop in encouraging ways. And he explicitly contrasted that with George W. Bush's response to 9/11, which he portrayed as a way to make sure you don't solve the problem, as a kind of block or inhibition on the impulse to find, no matter what the who the adversary is, some alternative to perpetual war, essentially. And I think megaterrorism, in this sense of these very traumatizing incidents, which challenge the whole political system, it's not just an event that can be isolated, create this understandable impulse that Hollande recently expressed in his reaction to the Paris attacks, that one should treat terrorism as a form of war rather than as a crime. That this choice of discourse is extremely important. It's understandable because of, as I say, the magnitude, the scale, and the exposed vulnerability of a society makes it something other than a typical terrorist incident that can be isolated and addressed as it always had been, as a species of crime. In other words, an occasion for perhaps enhanced law enforcement, but not the kind of event that is the occasion for mobilizing a society for war. At the same time, the nature of megaterrorism is such that the traditional template of war doesn't fit very well. What a country does to protect itself or prevail in war is really rather inapplicable in most respects or most crucial respects in responding to megaterrorism. The whole idea of deterrence doesn't work, retaliation doesn't work, so that the mentality that is appropriate to war is not appropriate to megaterrorism. And if you look carefully at the responses, both especially of the U.S., the 9/12 perspective rather than the 9/11 perspective, I think one sees that the attempt was to treat what happened as if it was a conventional, well, not a conventional, but a species of war as war had been experienced previously in Western society or in modern state system. And the immediacy of initiating a war against Afghanistan and then following that with the war against Iraq. And interestingly, by accident, I heard Donald Rumsfeld speak on NewsHour, the second anniversary of 9/11. And he said a very interesting thing, I think unwittingly. He said 9/11 was a blessing in disguise. That was his phrase. Now, why was it a blessing in disguise? He made clear that it enabled the U.S. to do some things that it wanted to do previously, but didn't have the political climate that would allow it to do it. If you may remember the so-called Project for a New American Century, which was a neocon text signed by many of the people that were very influential in the George W. Bush presidency, they said, America needs a new Pearl Harbor. That was their phrase. And again, what that meant in that context, of course, this was written before, I think, 1999 or 2000. What they were saying is, we need a political climate that will allow us to restructure the Middle East. That's essentially what it meant. And they were particularly interested in, they were very critical of the elder Bush for not finishing the job in Iraq. And it was partly, you know, kind of Freud, you can give it a Freudian spin and talk about the son wanting to outdo the father, but also it was a sense that the strategic interests of Israel and the U.S. depended upon or would be greatly benefited by having military bases in Iraq and having a presence in Iraq that would begin a process of restructuring the countries hostile to the West. See, and that this image was that was in the Project for a New American Century was a elaboration of what earlier had been in the Netanyahu Richard Perle study called Clean Break, which advocated the political restructuring of a whole series of countries, including Syria and others in the Middle East. So what I'm trying to say is that the American response to 9/11 was intertwined with grand strategy, with the grand strategy of the U.S., which it, at the end, after the Cold War, shifted from Europe to the Middle East and was preoccupied with oil geopolitics and security of Israel and the containment of political Islam, especially after the Iranian Revolution, as well as counter-proliferation. And all of those issues sort of focused on this region. And the neocons were the ones that were most articulate in identifying this geopolitical shift from Europe to the Middle East. So, and that's part of, this is part of why I think comparative study would be helpful in relation to megaterrorism, because these other countries don't have quite that same global grand strategy. They all have elaborate foreign policy. They all have their own originality. But what they don't have is this global security conception that has really distinguished the U.S. from any other country that has, in a way, ever existed. It's the first, what I would, it's not an empire, but it's a global state. In other words, it has, its reach is explicitly connected with a capacity to act anywhere on the planet. And no other country, I mean, first of all, it spends more on its military machine than the next 10 countries, maybe 15. It, at one point, was spent more than the rest of the world put together. That's an extraordinary thing if you think about it. And yet, it finds itself more insecure than it's ever been in its history. See, that juxtaposition seems to me to be very, very, and of course 9/11 greatly intensified that paradox. The strongest military power that ever existed, yet feeling extremely exposed and vulnerable. And if you read the memoirs of the people around Bush at that time, they were terribly frightened of their incapacity to defend the country. They really, genuinely, I think, believed that they didn't know what to do, essentially. And so they did the only thing that they knew how to do, which was to fight wars. It's not only the military budget, but it's also 1,000 or somewhere, it depends how you count, 700 to 1,000 foreign bases, foreign military bases. In other words, a global network of bases, navies in every ocean, and the militarization of space. All of these things are part of this securitization network that is global in scope. And so, in my view, that creates a particular political consciousness that is overly disposed toward dealing with mega-terrorism as if it's a predominantly military problem. And it's interesting what the demonization of the other is a common aspect of responding to any kind of terrorism. You demonize the other until you're ready to make peace. I mean, the IRA was demonized, the Basque movement in Spain, South African opposition to apartheid was, Nelson Mandela was considered the leading terrorist by the Africana elite, until that was no longer a useful posture. So yesterday's terrorist becomes today's Nobel Prize winner. It's a very much a manipulated and manipulable symbolism that is used by all countries. This isn't just an American phenomenon, or and Israel did it with the PLO, I mean, at one point. The famous Rabin Arafat handshake, in which Rabin couldn't quite get himself to look at Arafat, but the diplomacy of the moment validated bringing the PLO in from the cold and treating them as a political actor. So what I'm trying to express is the degree to which this way of thinking about and responding to megaterrorism. And I think this is where what I have to say corresponds very much with what Clark said yesterday, is that it, rather than solve the problem, it magnifies and intensifies the problem. And Chalmers Johnson reminded the world of the phenomenon of what he called blowback, which is a very much a characteristic of the response to the response. So we think about the challenge, and we think about the response to some degree. Not sufficiently, but there's also, it's worth focusing on the response to the response, which is, I think, what we're dealing with. And one of the things, there are two things that are very radical about these developments, starting with 9/11. If you look back at the relationship of the West to the non-West, it was always based on structured around two kinds of flows. Intervention came from the North to the South, and people came from the South to the North. You still have that. You have intervention in the Middle East and different forms in Asia and Latin America and Africa, but you have the migrations coming from the South to the North. See, and what the West had been able to do throughout the whole colonial period was to confine the violence to the combat zones of the South. And what, starting with Al-Qaeda and continue, maybe intensified by ISIS, is the notion that these forces that are seem to be under the domination of Western power, Western military superiority, they have options to strike back. They have the capability and the political will to strike back. See, before that, and if you even rather recently, U.S. Strategic planners were talking about zero casualty wars. That was the phrase used after the first Gulf War. And it was even more true in the NATO war against Serbia for Kosovo, the Kosovo War of 1999, where the Chinese had more casualties than NATO because we bombed the Chinese embassy was bombed in the course of the war as a way of telling them not to help the Serbs with targeting information. But there were no NATO casualties. That was truly a zero casualty war. In the post 9/11 world, there are no zero casualty wars. And always it was a Western fiction. There were lots of casualties. There were just no casualties on, quote unquote, our side. See, that whole notion that their casualties don't count, they're not even part of the reality. But our casualties are what's all important. And this is part of what I feel are the wrong lessons learned from the Vietnam experience in the American political culture. And that is, what the Beltway learned was get rid of the draft. The war was lost in American living rooms. Embed journalists. Try to control the perceptions of what has happened. Don't let people see the body bags coming back or the coffins draped in flags. Disguise the reality. And that's why no boots on the ground, but develop weapons and tactics that don't involve our casualties. Drones are perfect from that perspective. You don't even risk the idea of an accidental casualty. It's in a way the perfect weapon for the post-Vietnam security conscious, global security consciousness. So what I'm, I guess, all of this is trying to say that the worst aspect of the response patterns to mega-terrorism are the constraints imposed on political imagination of how to deal with this extraordinarily difficult and dangerous challenge. And putting it in a very simplistic way, we haven't learned to think outside the militarist box. And if you don't learn to think outside that box, you can't deal with this mega-terrorist challenge. I think that's the bottom line. And there's no way you can escape addressing the fact that there are real grievances out there. It's not good versus evil. You know, it's not that kind of morality play. And it's quite interesting that even in this American political consciousness, we've recognized in the Afghanistan context that if you really want to get out of that situation ever, you've got to talk to the Taliban. And there are these secret negotiations that have been going on and off in recent years. In other words, talking to the enemy is part of living in the 21st century. And if you don't understand that, one final observation. You may have seen an opinion piece by John Bolton, who's not a favorite of mine, but he advocated very interestingly that one should make a major military effort to eliminate ISIS from the territory it occupies in Syria and Iraq. But once eliminated, one should acknowledge that Iraq and Syria are no longer viable states, and that what one should do is essentially do what the ISIS is doing, create a Sunni state in the territory that is liberated from ISIS. In other words, accept their notion that they were being persecuted by the Shiites and that they had these substantial grievances. And if you saw the CNN film on the ISIS occupation of Syria and Iraq, it made clear the point that the people felt as bad, and many of them were very opposed to ISIS, but they said it wasn't as bad as what the Shiites had done to us while Maliki was prime minister. And that's an important observation. So let me stop there before I'm stopped. And
thank you for that talk. Is that going? So I want to pose to you the question of timing. And what I mean by that is that the big challenge of counterterrorism, and if you put counterterrorism in a very broad context and talk about it as political solutions to grievances all the way to dealing with genuine imminent threats, to me the big challenge of counterterrorism is a number of these things point in the opposite direction at the same time. So there's a security and a political and a realistic imperative that imminent threats have to be addressed, and some of those imminent threats either are never going to be amenable to any sort of negotiation, compromise. The Osama bin Laden, who's continuing to plan the next imminent attack, while at the same time, the means that you have for dealing with that imminency undermine a lot of the other project, creating better governance, trying to have a counter-narrative that says that the West is trying to, create a society in the best interests of the people in the Middle East to advance education, health, economic growth. So it's very difficult to do those two things at the same time. So I wonder if you could think about that.
I think you are absolutely right. I mean, and despite everything I said now, I favored the response to Afghanistan after 9/11, because I saw that, just for the reasons you suggest, that there was an imminent threat that was very hard to evaluate. But I regretted my what I said it actually, unfortunately, in print.
We all have that problem,
and so I had to live with it. And I was, quite sharply attacked at the time for taking such a position. But I think that is part of what I would call the appropriate political imagination for dealing with the mega terrorist challenge. That you have to recognize the special quality of the imminent threats and try to address them, but you shouldn't overlook the reality of legitimate grievances, of root causes, of trying to address the landscape out of which this kind of violence emerges. And until you do both, I would argue, you will not make significant progress.
If you look at Bush's speech in 9/20 to the Congress, a lot of it contains many different elements. And he even had programs like, I can't remember the exact name, but the Middle East Initiative Program, which was about trying to, build civil society structures and the Middle East. And the problem is that that whole project just got overwhelmed, or that side of everything just got overwhelmed by Iraq. I think there was political imagination, but like the Iraq War, the execution was just miserable.
You have to ask, why did it get overwhelmed by Iraq? And it got overwhelmed by Iraq because they always prioritized the grand strategy. And it was only... I remember that 9/20 speech, you didn't feel that there was the same, that there was part of the speech was rhetoric and part of the speech was policy. And I would argue that the non-military part was pretty much rhetoric, except maybe for not turning against Islam as a religion. I think that was genuine part of the speech. But the whole way in which Saudi Arabia was treated in the aftermath is part of this deconstruct the relationship between the mega-terrorist challenge and grand strategy. Saudi Arabia, despite being the greatest disseminator of jihadist Islam, has never been put under serious American pressure to stop doing that. And it's even with this reduced anxiety about oil reserves, still the friendship, the special relationship with Saudi Arabia exempts it from the kind of response that would occur if, for instance, Iran was doing something like this. It's these special relationships with Israel and with Saudi Arabia are very relevant, in my view, to how mega-terrorism has been addressed.
Richard, I'd like to follow up on the your suggestion in terms of the comparative study of the I think it's that's really important. I expect you're on to a really important observation. There's no doubt in my mind that they would respond differently. Even though it's still within the U.S.-UK area, even in the response, if you look at what happened in after 7/7, as you mentioned, in terms of the way that the British government and British press responded to the presentation of what happened on 7/7 versus the United States, you will see tremendous differences. So. I have a study that, which we did with a former student here, Mary Brentson, in which we looked at the coverage in the elite papers in the U.S. versus the U.K. And along the same lines of this, of what Ben and I and the others were doing in terms of this larger project, in terms of the long sweep on Al-Qaeda, there are extraordinary differences. In the U.S., even though the country that we can cover best of any place in the world in terms of the correspondence, location, numbers, understanding of culture, etc., our coverage is very, very different than the British coverage. The British represented Blair, who wanted to make sure that it wasn't that the attacks weren't connected to the Iraq War, because politically it was unacceptable to be attacked for having British participation. And so it was constant that it was homegrown, it was not connected to anything else in the world, etc. In the United States, of course, that was reported, but it was overwhelmed by the coverage that this was part of the global war on terror, which was Bush's immediate response and all the administrative response. And it followed that tack. And so as a result, you get a very different response in terms of how people think in terms of the public and the elite, think about what you need to do. And it, ironically, the homegrown terrorism, we did an experiment to see how this would affect population. The homegrown experiment frame of this, we did a video compilation of news reports, made people far more fearful and willing to not to go to war, because that wasn't what they wanted to do, but to give up civil liberties and to restrict not only their own civil liberties, but, of course, the Muslim population. And the international threat, maybe because in the U.S. it wasn't seen as big, but then the international threat just did not have that same impact. So the imagination that was generated by the way that it was framed was very, very different.
I didn't know that, but it corresponds with my sort of assumption of how these different political cultures address or frame their responses. I was very interested in the Spanish response to the Madrid train bombings. I happened to be in Spain. I arrived in Spain the day that the bombings took place. And there was a national election a few days later in which a pro-Bush leader, Aznar, was defeated and a new leader emerged. And the first thing that new leader did was to withdraw Spanish troops from the Iraq War. They had been part of the coalition in Iraq. And the other thing they did was to make a strong emphasis on law enforcement. And they actually were able to find the perpetrators who were not homegrown. They were Moroccan, I believe. But it completely contained the experience. For Spain, it was definitely a mega-terrorist event. I was in Barcelona, and there were something like a million people that took part in a very moving demonstration the next day, mainly with Catalan flags, not very few Spanish signs of Spanish identity. But nevertheless, it was in solidarity with the victims of which were quite, given the size of Spain, it was a sizable, probably equivalent to the casualties endured here after 9/11.
Just as an addition, though, one of the reasons that you saw that as a result was because the initial reaction by the Spanish government was to try to point fingers at ETA.
Yeah, that's true.
Even though, and most people don't realize this, but I have a lot of time on my hands, it was 911 days after 9/11. So that if you ever sat down and said, wait a second, it's what's the date, you knew it was Al-Qaeda. But they tried. And so I think maybe the response of the Spanish government to withdraw the troops and the election was an upset, in part because of the mishandling of the allocation of blame. So I applaud and agree entirely that we need to have this comparative element, because I think one of the problems, and not in this room, since there's a lot of people who've been working on terrorism for two decades plus, is that when everything we think and know about terrorism is shaped by that one event on 9/11, the prism through which we look at future events is so heavily contextualized, like along the lines of Michael, the paper that you guys are doing. It's, you know, everything's Al-Qaeda. But when you take a longer look and you do it in a comparative way, and you can look at the Irish Provisional IRA, you can look at the dissidents, you can look at ETA and how it was absorbed. You can look at like Donatella della Porta's work on Brigata Rossa, the Red Brigades, about how they became irrelevant because they went too far. I think that it's important that we understand the cases of things that worked is not in the Islamic sphere. It's what worked in sort of the older terrorist movements of the 60s.
No, thank you, Mia, for that comment. And I completely agree that Asner pointed the finger immediately at the ETA movement, and that was part of what people thought contributed to his defeat by this kind of misleading and opportunistic way of responding. The one thing I would say in your broader comment, in response to your broader comment, is that it's important to contextualize beyond the terrorist subject matter itself. That's why I think in dealing with the U.S. particularly, its grand strategy gets intertwined with counterterrorism. And what it, because counterterrorism is such an effective way of politically mobilizing support, other things that are not very prudent and not very wise get approval, find political approval. And the Iraq War is, of course, the poster child for that kind of assessment.
Terrorism is the new baseline or the new norm of the postmodern world, the neo-Westphalian world. And I think what the U.S. is doing is we're trying to hang on to the old modern Westphalian world using that grand strategy. And we haven't accepted the fact that times are changing. We're getting new war-making entities like the cartels or IS or AQ. And, you know, we're even seeing mercenaries return to the battlefield. And in many ways, it's very much like the shift from the medieval to the modern era, that level of change within the system.
No, I think that's a very important way of putting it, and I think you see it in the military technology, the shift to drones, and the doctrine, the world as a battlefield. You know, it's no longer state-centric in the response to mega-terrorism, and indeed the ISIS, Al-Qaeda also see the world as a global battlefield. So you don't have the territoriality of conflict in the way the modern world experienced and understood and prepared for it. So it is, as you say, a systemic change. And we haven't, the people that are trying to make the policy haven't caught up with the reality. So we're living in this kind of historical moment where the change, the behavioral changes are not addressed very convincingly by the policy or the governmental elites and the policy elites. So it's a very dangerous time for that reason, or one of the reasons it's dangerous.
Professor, thank you very much for the lecture. My question, I'm from Spain, and I wanted to make a question about this point in concrete. That it's curious that in all the countries, when there is committed a terrorist attack, there is like what is called the effect, I don't know how you say in English, join around the flag, no? Roll around the flag, yeah.
What, you, I didn't catch that.
The roll around the flag, like, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, like automatically, for example, the other day, I saw some polls and some surveys that in Paris, the popularity of François Hollande increases automatically. Or, for example, with Jorge Bus or Tony Blair, the days after the terrorist attack, the same. However, in Spain, happened something completely different. I mean, even when the causes and the reasons why the terrorist attack was committed could be more or less fair by certain groups and could be understandable by certain groups. What explains that in Spain there is that lack of unity facing a terrorist problem and nor in other countries apart from the lie, because as you said like there was a moment that the government said that was the Basque movement who committed that terrorist attack, but even before was clarified that was not the Basque movement, his popularity decreased automatically. Could you, why Spain has that situation?
No, it's a difficult, important issue. And I think the one of the difficulties in this whole terrorist context is that it is such a seductive way to mobilize political support. And as you say, it can opportunistically create this kind of artificial unity and patriotic surge of enthusiasm that gives the governing elite a mandate to do whatever it wants, essentially. And again, my familiarity here with the American political culture, see, I connect the way in which we have militarized the responses to the gun culture that is embedded in the society itself. In other words, the whole don't tread on me ethos of American society is extremely biasing in the way we think and act in response to challenges. Now, again, this is, to me, would be illuminated by some more comparative study of how, what is the defining metaphors for other political cultures, you know, how do Latin American countries or Spain or India address the same issue? Do they have that same kind of underlying alpha male view of how to deal with threats? See, and I think that's so important in the American context, aside from all these other dimensions of militarization that I alluded to.
I teach at California State University at Long Beach, and last night they had a forum on our campus talking about international terrorism, and in particular because on November 13th, one of our students, Noemi Gonzalez, was killed sitting at a restaurant in Paris by terrorists. So it raised a great deal of awareness. And in part of this, what I'd like to ask would be the ramifications that you see in terms of international law, in particular, the balance between state security and civil rights, human rights. And in particular, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And in response to this, there were particular presidential candidates who laid the blame at Edward Snowden. And the debate going on about civil rights, and in particular surveillance, and cyber rights and so forth. I think I was wondering if you could speculate about where you see the trends moving in these areas.
It's a very important question. Actually, I have a former student who's Larry Jor, who's very interesting on these kind of issues. Oh, is that right? Yes. Yeah. He's a very good guy. Very smart, too. I think it's what I regarded as a world order challenge, not an international law. International law was really made for a state-centric world. And it's obsolete, really, when you're dealing with these issues from both sides, both from the side that is resisting what they regard as an oppressive international political order and the side that's trying to stabilize that order. Both sides have to really break the logic of state centrism in order to formulate their own policies and their own behavior. So we're in a new world order situation which has no normative order. There's no normative framework that we can use. And even the ethical frameworks of respecting innocence or respecting civilian life, both sides have violated that in radical fashion. And certainly the Western liberal democracies, the way they fought World War II, was mega forms of state terrorism. I mean, when you drop atomic bombs on Japanese cities that have no military relevance to the war, and Japan is trying to negotiate an end to the war in any event, that's, if you don't call that terrorism of the most enduring kind. And you know, if you, everywhere but the United States, the two images that exemplify the horror of World War II are Hiroshima and Auschwitz. Those are the two things people remember as traumatizing images. I don't know how. I think there needs to be another project on generating a normative order for a post-state security system. We don't have it. And all these Snowden questions, it's a legit. I mean, I'm basically sympathetic with what Snowden did, but the other side has a point, because, and it goes back to the imminent threat comment and question earlier. There, you have to do something, and what is it you do that doesn't imperil everything else you believe in, or supposedly believe in? So it's a very complicated and difficult, and nobody, anyone that says they have the answers is a liar. You know, and Donald Trump may be the best exemplification of that truism. There's one more. Should we give one more question?
Back your play on this one, because we can't just come from a law enforcement, you know, type perspective. It's too. This is too big for that, and that puts us within the Western, you know, centric paradigm of states. What I think is happening is warfare itself is shifting from state-centric sovereign issues into something where we have challengers to that system. And the wars are about, you know, political and social organization, how people are going to live, what are the rights are we going to have slavery, are we going to have all these issues. So in some way, we're pre-modern, but also post-modern in the debates and the wars that are kind of coming here.
Yeah, no, I completely share that view.
Thank you.
Good.
Welcome back. We are now going to hear from the co-convener of the conference, Richard Burchill, on legal constructions.
Right. Thanks, Michael. Just want to sort of convey a bit of personal thanks to everybody. Very enjoyable conversations yesterday, both the presentations and the discussions. I'm learning a lot. So certainly appreciate being here and look forward to the rest of the day. Now, I got to admit, typically when you come to sort of interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary events and you suggest to talk about law, you got to spend the first sort of hour trying to justify why you're going to bother to talk about the law. So I must say, I have been pleasantly surprised, have very much welcomed the references, the discussion, some of the debates we've already had about legal aspects of terrorism. So I guess I'm encouraged that we do have something to talk about, something to share. At the same time, given some of the comments we've heard as well, I'm going to struggle slightly to say something new, something interesting. And I see that Professor Falk has left. All right, after declaring international law is obsolete, I'll have to try to find a reason to have a discussion about it. Now, I do recognize as well that when we're talking about legal constructions of terrorism, we are talking about formal, hierarchical, institutionalized things. And I know for a lot of people in the social sciences, well, we have to hate it from the outset because it's formal, it's hierarchical, it's institutionalized. But that's the way it is, that's the way it works, that's the way we understand law. But also in this area of terrorism or counterterrorism, we're seeing uses of law, appeals to law, framing a lot of our debate, part of the emotive structures that we've talked about. It seems to have a very large role, seems to be doing a lot of different things, but that's also part of the problem. The way the law is being used in a whole variety of different ways, and we're actually seeing some significant problems in how we go about constructing our legal understandings of terrorism. And these problems aren't just about sort of incoherence, sort of a lack of understanding, but it's actually now starting to demonstrate it's getting in the way of cooperation to try to respond to terrorist activities. And it's also getting in the way, I mean, as Anthony was telling us yesterday, of trying to deal with some of the core causes. So what I find intriguing is that we seem to be desperate to create bigger, more legal regimes to deal with terrorism. We want more law. That seems to be the answer to everything. And this has been a process that's been going on for a number of years, but yet there's still call for more law, both internationally and domestically. Now, we've already heard from the presentation so far that we can see some of the problems when we're looking at legal constructions. The definition issue is obviously huge. Do we define what we're looking at, or we define at our responses? How does that help us out? We do have to do something. I mean, if a politician just stand back and sort of say, well, not to worry about it, it won't happen again when the bodies start piling up, as was eloquently put yesterday, we do have problems. Also, the politics of it, yes. Legal constructions are a result of political, social, and cultural aspects. We can't get away from that. If we look at it at a global perspective, we have 190 plus whatever states. There's a lot of differences in views, perspectives, and what actually needs to be done. What I want to sort of look at is when we create these sort of legal constructions is first off identifying the act we want to look at, because laws have to be somewhat precise in identifying what the problem is. Then this sort of administrative structure revolves around it, about enforcement, investigatory powers, how we deal with it. But then also, there has to be a rhetoric behind it. Why is this law important? Why do we have it in our society? What purpose does it serve? And this rhetoric in dealing with the law on terrorism is quite interesting because it's a very high part of that emotive aspect, and we seem to be grasping at a lot of straws. And also, the biggest problem, and some of the discussions I had informally yesterday, is that we don't necessarily need to be constructing more law to define terrorism, but it seems states and governments are desperate to have more law for earlier interventions, for more authority, for investigations. But yet, at the same time, they keep saying they want more and more and more. So we hear these great news stories, terrorist plot was foiled, our legal system's great, our police are doing a good job, but then there's some sort of attack, we need more legal systems. We need more laws. We need more powers in there. So in looking at sort of the act, the administration, and the rhetoric part of it, we can see some of the problems, some of the difficulties in trying to construct some of these ideas of dealing with the legal understandings of terrorism. Now, to reference Clark once again, I think a number of people said he summarized it quite well. And from my perspective, he has summarized it quite well. Governments do need to show this really strong response, this emotive response, and they're doing it. Whereas they may be better off just using the systems they have in place, and in that way it won't be too much of a difficulty. When looking at sort of legal constructions, there is an issue about precision. We do have to clearly or attempt to clearly define what it is we're talking about. So yes, I understand as social science researchers, we can come up with multiple definitions depending on multiple purposes to achieve multiple objectives. Fine. But when the legal system's created, it has to come up with at least a somewhat precise definition. It has to come up with something coherent. It has to come up with something that allows for predictability, allows for action to be taken, hopefully, potentially allows for a strategy as well. But we're starting to see, I don't think there was ever a decent construction of terrorism through legal terms, but we're starting to see an absolute falling apart of it. Everything now almost seems to be terrorism, or everything you do can be associated with terrorism, and we're getting into circular arguments. If you do this act, you're a terrorist, because these acts are terrorist acts, and we just keep going around and around in circles without ever defining what it is we're actually looking at it. And as I mentioned, poorly constructed legal regimes cause problems. They may add to the sense of grievance, the sense of injustice for some. They may feel the law is picking on them. But more importantly, at a practical level, they actually create problems. If we can't actually go into communities and talk to people to find out their thoughts, their ideas, to help deal with some of those underlying factors, because to even talk to them is contributing to a terrorist cause, which we're seeing in a number of countries, that creates problems. Plus, we're starting to see in the level of international cooperation on dealing with counterterrorism, real problems. States are building up their domestic legal systems to such an extent that they can't even talk to each other about terrorism anymore because their understandings, their constructions are at odds with each other, and it causes large political difficulties. So one scholar has said, essentially, global counterterrorism is a bunch of sovereign ships passing in the night someplace. And it doesn't actually help. Now, one of the things we've talked about quite a bit is terrorism as being different than other criminal acts and how it has to have a certain gravity to it. We have to sort of amplify the importance. And this is something international law is now attempting to deal with. And this is what I find intriguing. I'll use one example from international law to show how sort of problematic our constructions are. We hear on a regular basis that there are maybe 13, 15, 19 international treaties dealing with counterterrorism. Now, this is an interesting example in its own right. We seem to have a large number. And so some people say, well, that's a treaty. No, that's just an addition to a treaty. No, we'll call that a treaty as well. It shows we're doing more. So even the UN can't figure out how many global terrorism treaties it has. Very interesting on that one. But everybody wants to go for a big number. What I find interesting in this sort of category of treaties, quite often called the suppression treaties, up until the 1980s, not a one of them mentioned the word terrorism. And they weren't even designed to deal with terrorism at the time. But retrospectively, we now say, ooh, these are part of our global framework for dealing with counterterrorism. The first suppression treaty in 1963, dealing with offenses aboard aircraft, is a great example of this. It was drawn up so states could better deal with jurisdictional issues over aircraft. We had a new phenomenon, these things flying back and forth. What happens when there's a problem on board? Who has jurisdiction over it? Who's responsible? So it's a very pragmatic thing to deal with international cooperation. But all of a sudden, 20 years down the road, we now start saying it's a counterterrorism treaty. And it's like, well, why? Mainly because of the act, offenses aboard of aircraft. But these offenses were illegal under most jurisdictions anyway. So why do we need to classify this as counterterrorism is a bit of a problem. More of a problem was the sort of offenses, the mischief the act was designed to deal with. Quite simply, it says that any offenses against criminal law are illegal under this treaty. Fine. But then it also goes on to say other acts whether or not they're illegal, that jeopardize the safety of the aircraft, or jeopardize good order and discipline. Very vague sort of emotive type of term of good order and discipline. And I emphasize this one because that's what we're starting to see in some of the domestic law now. Any act which jeopardizes this very vague understanding becomes quite problematic. But from this, international law started developing more acts, more administrative arrangements for dealing with these acts, and started to delve into a bit more of the rhetoric about it. So we saw in the various treaties that were adopted in the 70s and the 80s, states must adopt more severe penalties for dealing with these things. States must agree to cooperate with each other so we eliminate the possibility of anybody escaping prosecution. But at the same time, as we've talked about already in a number of ways, these acts that they were dealing with, you know, blowing up airports, killing people, kidnapping, hijacking, were already criminal offenses. But the idea was that you had to make it a much more severe penalty to address the problem. And believe it or not, some of these treaties started talking about this is a good deterrence. I'm not really sure the deterrence factor ever worked or where it came from. But the interesting point was that up until 1997, we never had mention of the word terrorism. Things changed in 1997. We had a convention on terrorist bombings, and in 1999, we had a convention on terrorist financing. The convention on terrorist bombings gives us the act. It's unlawful to illegally place an explosive device. But it also gives us the intention. Your intention is to cause death or great damage. Doesn't mention your motive. And that's an interesting thing about the constructions we're seeing today, where act and intention is, or act and motive are displacing act and intention. And that's going to cause difficulties down the road. Same with the terrorist financing convention. They had to actually come up with some sort of definition of terrorism, for good or bad. But again, it is about causing death, injury, damage to property, to intimidate or to compel somebody to do something. And then the international system kept trying to work on an agreed definition. They can't come up with it. Or they've actually been able to come up with an agreed definition. They can't come up with the whole treaty because they're not sure who the definition applies to. Motive is becoming more important than the intentions. And I'm not going to go through the various definitions because we've already had a bit of a discussion about that. But essentially what we've seen in the international system is more and more legal responses. Post 9/11, 2001, we see a massive jump in the number of countries that have agreed to these treaties. So these treaties have been around from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. They had a decent take-up, 60, 70 states. Not bad, not that great. Post 9/11, everybody signed up to them all of a sudden. And everybody took that as an authority to start changing their domestic law on terrorism as well. Which is intriguing because one of the purposes of these international treaties was it was actually permissive jurisdiction. It allowed you to create this crime under your domestic legal system. So you didn't have to go through the legislature to pass it. You had jurisdiction. It gave states a pile of authority to do stuff. But yet they felt they needed to do more, they needed to do more. Which to me demonstrates either a complete misunderstanding of terrorism or a complete misunderstanding on how we deal with it. But it also created this sort of rhetorical, this normative situation where we want to sort of outright condemn terrorism, condemn the use of violence through illegal means to intimidate or compel somebody to do something. Now, the impact these sort of international legal constructions had on the domestic has been quite marked. We're starting to see the acts, then the rhetoric. So forget the administration side of it. Let's forget developing effective application of this law. Let's get right into the importance of this, and then let's have the emotive side of it and essentially start shooting in the dark, both literally and figuratively. One of the biggest problems we're seeing in the domestic sphere, as I've already mentioned, is we're just sort of saying that if we find what you believe in to be offensive and you do one of these acts, then you have to be a terrorist. And if we're going to designate you or see you as a terrorist, then that just securitizes a whole range of other issues and allows us to do other things. Earlier interventions, investigations, lack of decent criminal trials, rights get removed, a number of other things. This is causing real problems with a number of criminal law systems, because domestic criminal law systems look at the act. It's illegal to kill somebody. Okay? Then it starts looking at the intention. Did you purposely kill somebody, or did you unintentionally kill somebody? And then we'll answer that question. So it's the act and then your state of mind in doing it. Nobody asks about the motive. But now the domestic systems are bringing in the motive. And the motive is getting very vague. This is, on one hand, is actually making it more difficult to prosecute, to arrest, to get investigatory powers, because you can't prove the motive, even though it's still an illegal act. Or, on the other hand, there's a whole range of examples. States are just using these powers to deal with anything they don't like. So I'm not sure if it's ironic or just really problematic. France is currently dealing with protesters at the climate change through the emergency powers they brought in to deal with the terrorist attacks. And that just is not acceptable if we want to come up with something more coherent that actually helps us to deal with the problem. Part of the emphasis on motive, I believe, is also just misplacing our efforts and our concerns. Take the unfortunate recent events here in California and San Bernardino. The newspaper this morning had a huge headline. What was their motive? And it's like, well, why do we need to be getting their motive into this? They've killed 14 people. That's murder. End of discussion. They're dead. But if they were still, if we had them in custody, let's prosecute them and move on with it. It's this interesting dilemma now that we're seeing at both the international and the domestic level. States are desperate to show they have these strong legal systems. For some reason, they want to be telling everybody that we can take care of all these people that are going to threaten us one way or the other. But yet, they seem to be moving, as we were discussing yesterday, to what you believe in threatens us. And so we're going to somehow start to criminalize that. We're going to somehow start to prohibit that. But that's a real problem, because if I just sit at home thinking about robbing a bank, they can't come and arrest me. Okay, so my motive is to go rob a bank and get rich. But if I'm just sitting at home thinking about it, what do we do? Equally, if people are sitting at home and they're thinking about overthrowing the government, do we sort of say, well, their motive is a problem, so the act and the intention we're not going to sort of worry about, it's just going to get straight to their motive. That can become problematic. And looking at some of the other elements to it, focusing on the motive allows the emotion come into it. It gets very subjective, it gets very problematic, and it gets very inconsistent. That's the other difficulty. And I think that's something that Anthony pointed out quite well in the UK situation. The inconsistency is a real problem. There's also a practical problem. The more law, the more availability has not resulted in better law enforcement, better investigations, better supervision processes. The Belgium example following the Paris attacks was classic. You had a local administrator, you had a state administrator, and you had a federal administrator all saying they spoke to each other. Security forces all knew about it, but this person didn't really care. It was competition between the security forces. So the over-dramatization or the over-emotive factor in dealing with terrorism as a crime seems to be actually hindering cooperation, because you have the authorities sort of competing with each other to either resolve the problem or say it's not our problem. And I'm not really sure how we can get along with that. But essentially, as we start looking at constructions of terrorism and law, we do need to try to find things that are precise, predictable, identifiable, so we can actually respond to the mischief, to the problem we're trying to address. Right now, I mean, again, just to use sort of Clark's view, they just want to show that we're having this huge response, and that's it. And they're not sort of thinking it through. I mean, again, the UK is a great example. How many different counterterrorism or counter-extremism bills, acts, have they had since 2000? Every year, if not every other year? And they still haven't come up with a way of resolving the problem. So the difficulty we're seeing is that I can see the use for law. I can see why we should have it. I can see how it can help. At the same time, it definitely looks like bring in the emotive element, which has really added a lot to the way I look at this, is helping us to explain where the problems are. We're not actually getting any coherence out of it. And I think what we're going to see, if these developments continue in this direction, which all signs indicate they're going to be, in attempting to deal with the issue of terrorism, both at sort of stopping extremism, stopping radicalization, we're going to struggle. and attempting to deal with it in terms of just criminal justice techniques, police powers, investigatory aspects, we're going to struggle because we've over-securitized the issue. And certainly, in many respects, we're adding to the rhetoric of the bad guys in many respects. We're just giving evidence to show that, yeah, our systems aren't working. Our systems are oppressive. Our systems are out to get you because that's what you believe. So forget the fact if you've done it or not. It's just you. That's who we're out to get. So, I mean, just to conclude, it was quite disturbing after 9/11 that Jeremy Greenstock, the UK ambassador to the UN, said what looks, kills, and smells like terrorism is terrorism. Unfortunately, our legal constructions are going in the same way. Thanks.
Thanks very much for that presentation. Just to reinforce one of your main points, the shift from intention to motive in criminal law is a radical change, because what we were taught in law school was that motive is irrelevant, not only that it's not part of, but it should be excluded from the assessment of crime. And the International Court of Justice has made that very clear in the worst of international crimes, genocide, where they put a very high threshold on establishing the specificity of the intent and completely ignore the motive. Yeah. So the treatment is, it seems to me, a really radical modification of the way in which criminal law jurisprudence has been generally understood in liberal Western societies. Mm. One other observation that again, I think flows from what you were saying. In the 1960s in South Africa, the anti-terrorist laws were used to criminally punish anyone who advocated a changed racial relationship between Africans and the white population. So it does have a, there is a long experience of using the emotive side of terrorism as a way of demonizing that which the governing elites don't want to have happen, and use in integrating that into the legal order.
Yeah. But I think part of the difficulty we're getting with that second point is that it almost seems like everybody's doing it now. And they're not just pointing to the system being under threat, but they actually use the words, the current government, which can get real problematic because you can essentially just use it against all your sort of opponents. And it's not just in those non-liberal states. It's happening on a much wider scale, either directly or indirectly. But you're right. I mean, it's not new in that respect. But also on your point about the intention, the motive, most definitely in domestic law, yeah, we don't even ask the motive. But what I find interesting with these suppression conventions as it developed over time, and again, this is trying to put a reading on international law, the preambles did start to sort of say these acts threaten international peace and security. They started to read a little bit of a motive in it, even though in international law, anything that threatens international peace and security is a catch-all term. So it's not really that important. But at the same time, they were starting to look at some sort of motive in a way, because again, they didn't seem to be that worried about the intention. But that was a framework on top of the domestic law, so it's less of an issue at that level, yeah.
I was just curious about, so the thing that this kind of started to make me think about when you talk about the role of motive when in the criminal process was specifically with hate crimes. And my curiosity was whether this same argument that you're making is also an argument against hate crime legislation, and if you could just kind of expound on that thinking.
Yeah, I mean, the purpose of hate crime legislation wasn't to create a new offense. It wasn't there to create, it was there to add to the process. So you beat somebody up, you murder somebody. That in itself is the crime you're going to be prosecuted for. The hate crime element, and again, hate crimes are causing problems. They're not, the legislation is not all that clear in certain places. They're causing difficulties for prosecution. You did see at first in a number of jurisdictions, everything became a hate crime. And oops, this is actually causing more troubles than it's worth in many respects. And again, it's there. That's part of the rhetorical process. We want to demonstrate that if people go and they do this because of, then that is a problem. But again, motive doesn't quite fit into it in a way one could argue, because the purpose of the hate crime is that you beat somebody up, you killed somebody because of one of their attributes. You weren't out there, you weren't motivated by it. You were using it as the object of your violence. Now, but then again, others will argue that it is a motivation. That's the only reason you attack that person. And this is part of the difficulty. Because, I mean, there's been some cases in the UK where during a fight or during a violent thing, somebody said an offensive term. That must be a hate crime. And they said, well, the understanding of it afterwards, that wasn't even close to being a hate crime. But yeah, it's a similar sort of aspect. Yeah, we're seeing this. We want to move towards this motivation. I'm not sure if it helps us, but again, it shows governments trying to deal with what they perceive to be a problem based on the social pressures they're feeling.
So I've got two questions. The first is, if you had to boil this down to a policy prescription, right? So we made you international law dictator. What? That sounds attractive. What would you recommend is that policy prescription we need to do to make this function in a useful way?
I mean, essentially, I think it's one of those things. Yes, we need to put the label of terrorism on a lot of these things to help ensure it gets people going, to help ensure we can get the resources into it, to help ensure we can get the cooperation. But we have to keep in mind that the acts we're looking at are already criminal acts. So we don't have to make a huge jump. And the jump is relatively straightforward with the intention to cause terror, the intention to cause a disruption, major disruption, to intimidate, to compel somebody. So we already have the offenses, and we just need to sort of look at the intention side of it. And all this other ancillary stuff that's happening around it, just leave that alone, okay? Stop sort of piling everything into it at the same time. So the policy prescription would be just keep it narrowly defined. You will be able to prosecute. You will be able to act upon it. You will be able to create a rhetoric around it to show you're doing something. But at the same time, I mean, this point was brought up yesterday, if now everybody who's motivated to commit violence is obviously intending to overthrow the government, we have to investigate everybody in society. So what do we do now? If we keep going down this route, it's a complete waste of time and resources.
Well, it certainly would up some people's budget, which I think has something to do with it. my other question is, based on the discussion we were having yesterday about definitions and operationalizations, and I have a biased desire for your answer here, do you think that this distinction you're making between motivation and intention is something we should be importing more fully into how we're thinking about operationalizing and defining terrorism within the context of research?
Can you give me a bit more on that? I'm not sure where you're going.
So if I'm sitting around and I just saw an incident or I'm looking at an organization and I'm trying to decide, does it go into the GTD, does it go into the bad data set? You've laid out a very interesting distinction between motivations and intentions. Mm. Should we be trying to adopt that kind of distinction and focusing on what you're talking about when we're trying to take, let's say San Bernardino or a domestic hate crime of another group how we're putting into
our list? No, not necessarily, because, I mean, like I said, when looking at the legal constructions, we are looking at formal aspects. But I can see the benefit, the need, to have different understandings, because it helps us to bring in other explanations. It helps us to bring in other factors to understand the wider process of it. No, I wouldn't sort of say let's keep it narrow and that will help us. It's not going to help us, really. Okay. But in the sort of more formal structures, we do need to be looking at not having multiple definitions, not having sort of multiple approaches to definitions, but trying to bring a bit more precision to the definition we want to use in the legal sphere.
Okay.
Yeah, I would like to make you one question. It's about in the international law. It's like One of the capacities that is given to the countries is they can have the capacity to recognize a nation. I mean, it's like a free capacity, a free power of the nations. What would happen? Do you think would be possible that suddenly one Middle East country or one Asian country, whatever, whoever would recognize the Islamic State as a new state? I mean, would be possible in the aspect that it's a free capacity. Do you think that would happen? Yeah. And in that case, how could that affect to a new international order?
I don't. From a PR perspective, I can't see any individual sovereign state recognizing them as a state. The whole recognition process is very much a political process and is tied up with a whole range of other things. So you could actually be a state, having population, territory, the ability to enter international relations, and nobody recognize you. Or everybody tries to recognize you, whether or not you have this capacity. So you have these very various gray areas. I can't really see anybody, and other people be interested in your views, anybody recognizing Islamic State, to be honest with you. I just... completely impractical, but I think just from a PR perspective, you'd have a hard time explaining that, not just your own population, no matter who you are, but trying to explain it to your neighbors. First time you show up at an international event, yeah, we're the guys that recognize Daesh. Oh, you go sit outside. You're right, it could happen. It happened in Afghanistan, where you had different levels of recognition, with only a few states recognizing the Taliban regime at one time, then withdrawing recognition down the road. Yeah, it's possible, but I don't see it happening.
But Islamic State has Mosul, it's the second most producer oil place. So they always have like a resource that can convince other countries to recognize them. You know what I mean? They have resources in that aspect for me.
Yeah, but again, it's a much bigger process. Kosovo is a great example. You have a European Union recognition, a number of Western states have recognized it, even though not all European Union states have, I don't think. But given the fact that Russia won't recognize it and Serbia won't recognize it, doesn't really matter if everybody else recognizes them or not. It's still caught up in that political process. No, I think Daesh having control over oil and resources would never force anybody to have to recognize it. They may have to recognize and deal with them as an insurgency, as we talked about yesterday, but never as a state. Perfect. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.